From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, spells and sorcery, but here's what's happening. A major story breaking here in the California area. The suspect, believed to be the notorious Golden State Killer, who was wanted in a dozen murders and nearly 50 assaults, rapes from the late 1970s to the mid-1980s, has been arrested in California. His name is Joseph James D'Angelo. He's 72 years old. He was arrested Wednesday at his Citrus Heights home. That's located about 16 miles northeast of Sacramento, after a DNA sample matched that of the Golden State Killer. County records show D'Angelo is being held at the Sacramento County Main Jail, where he is booked on several counts of murder. He is reportedly on a suicide watch. Officials said prosecutors will seek the death penalty against him. He is a former police officer. In a moment, more on this story for the next couple hours. The Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, has dismissed President Donald Trump as unqualified to deal with important international issues amid U.S. threats to potentially walk away from the landmark nuclear deal with Tehran. Rouhani spoke on state TV after the French leader, Emmanuel Macron, flew to Washington to meet with the president. Among Macron's aims was convincing Mr. Trump to stick with the 2015 pact, which saw Iran sharply curtail its nuclear program in exchange for the lifting of sanctions. Rouhani, a reforming cleric, unleashed a series of insults during his speech. Howard Bloom, who watches a lot of these issues for us, on the line with us now. And Howard, my friends from Iran who live here in Beverly Hills tell me that they think Iran could topple. They're tired of these mullahs.
Well, you've got it as a possibility. A controversial national security columnist at Bloomberg, Eli Lake, has advice for Donald Trump on the Iranian nuclear deal, and he says, don't pull out of the nuclear agreement. Just tie the Iranians up in endless negotiations and wait. Now, what does he want us to wait for? Wait for Iran to collapse. Exactly what you said. Since 1979, Iran has been run by religious scholars, religious fanatics. It's Ayatollahs, and the word Ayatollah means a supreme scholar of Islamic law. And the Ayatollahs have ruled with an iron hand, but these Muslim scholars are in serious trouble. In late December, Lake says, protests broke out throughout the country, and those Iranian protests haven't stopped. Instead, they've multiplied. Just look at the headlines from the last few months. Water crisis spurs protests in Iran. That's Reuters. Iranian steel workers hold protests. That's Voice of America. Security measures tightened in Iran's Ahwaz as protests continue. That's Saudi Arabia's newspaper Sharq al-Wasat. And topping all the other headlines, quote, is a military coup possible in Iran? And that's Al Jazeera. Then there are the banks. Lake says there's been a run on the banks. Now, I can't find evidence of that. But another Bloomberg report says that Iran is about to face something it's never experienced before, a full-blown banking crisis. The Iranian rial has gone down 30% in just 4 months, and banks are not giving loans. In fact, the bad debts on the books of Iran's banks could cause the nation's entire banking system to collapse.
Yes.
But that's not all. Lake says there's a drought. Crops are failing for lack of water. And says Lake, farmers are being driven off their land, and the regime has started arresting environmental activists. But that's not all. There was a leak of the official budget. It showed that billions of dollars were funneled to Iran's military and Revolutionary Guard Corps. For what? To make war in Syria and Yemen. To make expensive wars, quote, while Iran's youth unemployment rate continued to rise, close quote. That quote is from Lake. That leak set off more protests, protests in which, according to Lake, demonstrators chant slogans that proclaim Iran should focus on its problems at home and not on sowing mischief abroad. On top of that, Lake reports there's a debate and protest over the detention of a cleric who has dared to challenge the divine authority of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah al-Khamenei. And an even greater challenge, says Lake, comes from Iran's Nobel laureate and human rights lawyer, Shirin Ebadi, who, along with other activists, are now calling for indigenous regime change through a UN-monitored referendum that would eliminate Khamenei's position of supreme leader altogether. In other words, the Iranian government is in trouble. As a former Iran specialist for the Rand Corporation told Lake, Iranians want change, and Lake believes there is a democratic opposition that can take over if the Ayatollahs are driven for power. That's why Lake advises Trump to hold his horses and tie the Iranians up in endless negotiations. Just wait, says Lake. And just as you said, George, Iran will collapse from within.
That's right. Howard, thank you so much for your insight. Media watchdog Reporters Without Borders says hostility toward journalists is growing worldwide, often encouraged by political leaders, even in democratic countries. The group's annual Global Index of Media Freedom found that an overall rise in animosity toward reporters and a drop in freedoms, notably in former Soviet states, but also in countries from the United States to the Philippines. Fast food sandwich chain Subway expects to close about 500 stores in North America this year, but it's also hoping to open up as many as 1,000 stores overseas. What's going on with the economy? Let's check in with our expert, Andre Eglashon. Andre, not good news when these stores close.
No, it is absolutely not, George, and thanks for having me. Yeah, you're right. You know, they're talking about closing, you know, 500 stores here in North America this year, but Subway is also going to open up another, you know, 1,000 stores overseas. I mean, something like 27,000 of their stores are in the United States, but, you know, 17,000 of them are overseas. You know, this is going to lose jobs for us here in the United States. But at the same time, you know, I really think that we're going to see a demand growth of a lot of our exports right now, which will probably pick up some of the slack from the jobs that are lost through Subway, which should be minuscule. But, you know, because of all liquidity that is being pumped into the economy right now, because these petrodollars are coming back home, and they're coming back home big time, man, because of this, the surge in oil prices, it's going to give oil-producing countries a little bit more headroom to be able to buy, you know, a little bit more of what America produces. So if we see oil break the $70, $80 a barrel, you know, a lot of that money is going to go into sovereign wealth funds. We're going to see a lot of the oil companies themselves doing buybacks. But, yes, Subway is just reorganizing, man. You know, things are changing in this country. The economy is not doing well for everybody. If you're invested on Wall Street and if you are, you know, properly positioned, then, yes, you're doing well right now. And you can probably expect to do well going into the future, even though we're in a correction right now. It's the craziest economics I've seen, George.
It's strange.
I mean, how can you have, you know, a stock market in flux like we are right now, but yet, you know, the forecasts are for people to continue making money? That's because liquidity is being pumped into the U.S. economy through other means right now, including this coordination with the oil-producing companies and the resurgence of the petrodollar. So that's going to give us a little bit more breather for a while. We can live on borrowed money a little while longer, pseudo.
If oil goes too high, though, we got some problems.
Yeah, we'll have problems because it's going to hit the consumers. See, right now, as oil prices are surging, you know, profits and income and wealth is being extracted from the consumers and going to the producers. On the bright side of it, the producers of oil can buy more of what America produces, and that's my whole point here. And it's a balancing act. I mean, we've been riding the tiger like this, the back of the tiger like this, for quite some time. We'll just have to see how it all ends up.
All right, my friend. Andre's website, straightmoneyanalysis.com. As I mentioned earlier in the program, an arrest has finally been made in the decades-long investigation into the Golden State Killer, a rapist murderer who terrorized communities in at least 10 counties across California in the 70s and 80s. Joseph James D'Angelo, a 72-year-old former police officer, has been arrested. Ironically, just a few weeks ago, Keith Komos was on our program talking about this case, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Keith Komos, through exhaustive research of case files and interviews, has meticulously chronicled the brutal crimes committed by arguably what was the most elusive serial killer of the 20th century, a psychopath, a predator who steeped in criminal activity. Keith uses his experience in the technology field to apply modern scientific techniques to help resolve cold cases. He frequently is called on to do consultation work as well. He has co-written a book with Kat Winters called Case Files of the East Area Rapist / Golden State Killer. Was just on a few weeks ago on the program talking about this very case. Keith, little did we know that a suspect would be found so quickly. I have a feeling you knew something might happen.
There have been so many developments in this case over the past year, 2 years, that we knew that it would only be a matter of time. This case had DNA of the offender, which is rare in cold cases. So it really was just a matter of time, especially the way technology is advancing. I couldn't be happier to be back on your program so quickly.
Well, I'm glad you are, especially under this circumstance. With the DNA, were they pinpointed? How did they find this suspect? And, you know, we'll call him the suspect, of course. He hasn't gone to trial yet.
Right.
But how did they find him so quickly with the DNA?
They're actually being very tight-lipped on the actual process that they used and the actual chain of events that led to the actual arrest. I know that they've been using every available DNA technology, including these newer technologies where you can input the DNA and get back actual physical characteristics of the person, of the DNA that you're submitting. So it appears to be some good police work that was done in setting up some of these new technologies and crafting the inputs to where they would be useful to law enforcement, and then interpreting the results from these new technologies, and then running with the leads and using what they knew about the offender to narrow that haystack where the needle is kept, to shrink that haystack down to where they could work with a manageable amount of suspects and actually start to do some, to make some headway as far as identifying suspects. And there were several boxes that this particular suspect checks as far as who the Golden State Killer might have been. So I can see why he bubbled to the top of the list fairly quickly.
Keith, do we know at this point if these crimes were committed while this individual was still a police officer?
Yes, they were.
Oh, geez.
50, you know, the 50 rapes and attempted rapes that he's suspected to have committed were committed between 1976 and 1979. During that time, he was a police officer up in Auburn in California, which is not far away from where these occurred. So he was commuting a short distance to these attacks when he was committing them. And for him to be a police officer, what a disgrace to the badge.
Oh, my God.
He's the antithesis of everything that the law stands for. It's unreal. And a lot of the law enforcement folks that I know of in this case seem to be taking that fact really hard, because it's a terrible thing to find out.
Now, he apparently was fired as a police officer in Auburn after he was arrested for stealing a hammer and a can of dog repellent from a store.
I had to look up what dog repellent even is. You know, that's
it's something that I think postal employees used to carry these with them in case a dog attacked them or something like that.
Yeah.
But what a bizarre story. Why would you steal these things?
And the story is getting stranger by the minute. Apparently, he was apprehended in this store as he was tucking some dog repellent into his belt. And they took him to a back room, and he became belligerent and frantic, and they actually had to tie him down because he tried to flee the scene. And we now know he was afraid of being identified, probably as this serial rapist. At that point, he had committed some murders, but he hadn't made it his craft at that point. And this, he had already committed 50 rapes and attempted rapes at this point.
Unbelievable!
It's crazy. And that story is. And then there was some strange legal proceedings that occurred for the next 4 months after that, where he basically didn't contest his being fired from the police department, and he kind of faded off into the night, and it's a strange story. And shortly after that, he began killing all of his victims.
Keith, do we know when the crimes apparently stopped?
The last crime that we know of was in 1986. Now, before that, there was a crime in 1981, and then there was a 5-year gap. When looking at this suspect, the birth of two of his children occurred around both of those times, and those are the two big, long breaks that this offender took. So that's sort of eerie to look at, that impending fatherhood was possibly a factor in these murders occurring and him stopping for a period of time.
Well, if they've stopped, then it's been about 30-plus years.
It has.
How can a serial killer rapist simply stop for 30-plus years? I always thought this was in their system and they couldn't stop.
That's been the traditional thinking, is that they're wired this way. They have a compulsion. They have an obsession. This is all they can think about and do. We're now learning that there are cases of offenders stopping or taking long breaks or long periods of time. We thought maybe he was incarcerated. Maybe the offender was killed or injured or somehow couldn't offend anymore. Turns out he was alive. There was another serial killer named the BTK killer who also stopped for long periods of time.
Right.
And the literature shows that there's more and more of this. So the thinking on that needs to be adjusted. And this guy, he is not crazy. He was a tactical offender. He was organized. He would carry things out to the letter, and he would never slip up. So he was in control of himself enough to be risk averse and to commit all of these offenses without getting caught. He was also risk averse enough to stop.
I was looking at Wiki today on the profile of the Golden State Killer. And one of the things that just popped out was knowledge of police investigation techniques.
And now we know where that came from.
Now we know where that came from. Exactly.
He worked law enforcement from, I guess it was 1973 to 1979 for two different police departments. And he knew very well about fingerprinting techniques. One of the reasons the profile says that is halfway through the series, he stopped using his bare hands when he was assaulting the woman. A new technique had just been developed that allowed law enforcement to lift fingerprints off of bare skin. So the thinking was that he knew about
the
development.
And then he went into tying them up with shoelaces and things like that, didn't he?
Stuff that was basically untraceable because they would look at it under microscopes and new equipment and technology, and they couldn't find anything that would tie these shoelaces or these bindings to anything. He would get them from the victim themselves or from elsewhere or fresh out of a new pack, and he would use them there. And he didn't leave any physical evidence on the bindings or really anything else.
Now, Keith, the Golden State Killer killed 12 people, yet he committed 50-some rapes, as you mentioned. Why didn't he kill more people?
Well, he didn't start killing until toward the end of the crime spree, from 1979 until 1986. And I know that sounds like a lot of years, but
sure.
He would only commit one murder scenes during those years. And then from 1981 to 1986, he took a break. What the thought process is that he was still living up in Sacramento, 325 miles plus away from these scenes, and he was commuting down to commit these offenses. Some of the evidence already pointed that way because for the first intentional murder, he burglarized 5 homes that night, and then he committed murder. Rather than the burglaries being spread out and the prowling incidents being spread out, it looked like he was there for that night.
He also kind of switched techniques where when he broke into homes, he liked to break into a house where there was a couple, a man and a woman, sometimes even children, when he tied people up to commit his offenses.
Yeah, for his first 15 rape attacks, they were on lone women or houses where only women were present. All of a sudden, attack number 16, he switches to exclusively attacking heterosexual couples while they're asleep in bed, sometimes accosting them outside their home in the middle of the night.
Jeez.
And that was an intentional switch. The thought process behind that is that the newspaper printed something about he had only attacked lone females or single females. Well, his next attack was on a couple. Was he reading the newspaper? Was he taking that as a challenge? And if so, then he was. It shows something about the offender that he was following the media about himself, that he was enjoying this on another level, not just the attacks.
Because the stop 30-some years ago, did law enforcement think the individual could be dead?
There was a lot of thought that that he could be dead, especially because the traditional thinking is this guy has a compulsion to do this. He wouldn't or couldn't stop willingly. A lot of the former law enforcement that we talked to thought he's got to be dead. Now, there were some phone calls to former victims that took place, one in 1982.
Let's talk about that, Keith, when we come back. That's right. Somebody actually, the perpetrator, made phone calls back to the victim, threatening them. That's strange. We'll be back in a moment. Keith Komos, our special guest, the next hour when we take phone calls, questions, and if for some reason you have any experience with this kind of situation, if your home was broken into then, share the story. Next couple hours, we're talking with Keith Komos about the Golden State Killer. We'll take your calls next hour with him. I do want to mention a couple of our stage shows that are upcoming Saturday, June 9th in Las Vegas, Nevada at the Silverton Casino. And they tell me tickets are 70% sold out already, and it's not even June 9th. So take advantage of it. If you're going to be out in Las Vegas, come on by and see us. If you live in the area, definitely come by and see us. Full information at coasttocoastam.com. Click events at the top of the homepage, and they all open up. Look for the Las Vegas show. That is Saturday, June 9th. And then Saturday, August 25th, we are going to be back in Asheville, North Carolina for a live stage show at the Diana Wortham Theater. The website is dwtheater.com. Theatre is how they spell it. dwtheater.com. Make sure you put my name in the events and then just start searching and it'll pop up. Or go to coasttocoastam.com and pick up the tickets by clicking events or in our carousel reel at coasttocoastam.com. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Keith Komos with us, their book, Case Files of the East Area Rapist / Golden State Killer. A suspect has been apprehended in this very lengthy case. Keith, there are so many other cases that are tied to this individual. One is called the Visalia, California ransacker case. Tell me about this. They basically nicknamed him that, right?
They did, yeah. This was an offender who operated about 200 miles away from Sacramento, where the East Area Rapist got his start. And he operated between 1974 and 1975, usually on weekends. He would enter several unoccupied homes in one night, and he wouldn't take much. He wasn't doing it for financial value. These were more sexually motivated crimes. He would take things that were important to the victims, like personalized jewelry, their coin collections. And he seemed to be taking things that would damage them or annoy them in a way, because they spent time on doing these things and they spent a lot of effort in collecting these types of things. And then sometimes he would discard them nearby to show, I guess, that they weren't valuable to him. And this offender escalated over time, and he tried to kidnap a teenage girl in the middle of the night. Her father came to her rescue. He shot the father to death.
Jeez.
And he meant to shoot him to death because he shot him twice. And then he took off running. He had the brazenness to continue to offend in the exact same area for several more months until police on a stakeout confronted him. He shot at the police officer, probably intending to kill that police officer. And then there were only a couple more incidents in Visalia, and then he's gone. 6 months later, the East Area Rapist series begins. When we look at the suspect that was arrested, we look at D'Angelo's work history. He was living and working in Exeter, which is about 12 minutes away mm-hmm. from Visalia at this time. He was a police officer there. He became a police officer there in May 1973. The first incident tied to the Visalia ransacker was in May 1973 on South Demery Street. And
jeez.
These things start to line up. The more you look at this guy and the more you look at these suspects, what's new is that the Visalia ransacker was thought to maybe be the East Area Rapist because of some MO ties that they had between them and a couple other things and the timeline matching up. But there were some things that made it look like maybe it wasn't, because the Visalia ransacker would go in and he'd empty the women's drawers and take their underwear out and arrange them around the room and
jeez.
Sometimes pour orange juice or do something strange in the house. And the East Area Rapist didn't really do those things, but there were several things that they did do in common. So it was really an open question. But once this suspect was identified, then the answer was no longer murky.
Keith, I definitely want you to come back after more information is released about this suspect, because I really want to find out what happened to this person. I mean, what did people say? Was he a good cop? Besides the theft of the hammer and the dog spray, I mean, did they like him? Something obviously happened to this suspect in his life to cause this person to flip out and do what they did.
And that's the question that keeps us coming back.
Or has he been doing it all his life? Maybe there are more murders attributed to this guy.
And that we're going to find out, because there's one murder in particular down in San Diego that occurred between two of his other murders. And San Diego is not far away from Irvine and some of these other areas where he was offending. And it looks like him. The young woman was bludgeoned to death with a hammer. What was this suspect stealing when he was caught? He was stealing a hammer. And some of these cases, now that we know more about this suspect and some of these dots are being connected, some of these cases that we looked at and we thought, oh, maybe this was the guy, they're starting to be connected. The Visalia one was one that, you know, I researched with other people. I was strongly in the Visalia ransacker as the East Area Rapist camp. My research partner was in the opposite camp. So, but the more information that comes out, the more we're able to tie some of these tangential cases that we've looked at before but maybe dismissed, and we're able to rule out some of them. Others. Also, there was another murder that looks to be a lot less likely to be him, given what we know about the suspect.
Would this be a defense attorney's slam dunk for insanity to take that kind of a plea? I mean, what kind of a person would not be insane? And here's another question too, Keith, as we get into this. Ted Bundy, for example, the serial killer, was put to death. Why don't these serial killers simply say, I'm insane, and they live, but, you know, they're being held because they're insane? What sane person would do this?
A lot of it comes down to the definition of insanity. To you and me, this guy is totally nuts. To the courts, insanity is...
Or pure evil. There's one or the other.
Pure evil, definitely. And, a lot of the insanity defense rests on how cognizant he is of what he's doing. This guy held down a job, raised a family, had different relationships with different people, and committed crimes in between these things.
Horrendous crimes.
Exactly. And he was so prolific and committed so many crimes, but also was in the Navy. Held down a law enforcement job, committing crimes all the time and working all the time. I would imagine it would be very hard to prove that there was a Jekyll and Hyde thing going on where he would flip a switch and not know what he was doing.
Something happened in his childhood. He may have been abused. Who knows? But
who knows? Something.
How would he escape any kind of police interrogation? Or, you know, or psychological testing before he became a police officer? They put these men and women through these battery of tests. How would he get through that?
And that's another thing. He must have passed that. And that also weakens any kind of defense that he was just stark raving mad and didn't know what he was doing. But he did. This guy could obviously compartmentalize his life in such a way that he could remain unsuspected of committing what we're now learning are over 200 burglaries, 12, they're going to add a 13th crime for the killing of Claude Snelling at some point, and do all of this for 12 years, maybe more, and somehow escape detection. So he was obviously able to compartmentalize and was smart enough to pass these types of exams and to operate in a somewhat normal capacity.
I want you, Keith, representing this program, to talk to law enforcement and possibly see if you can get an interview with this suspect. Do you think you could try that?
That's something that's very high on our list of something to do. And Coast to Coast AM is internationally known for quality programming, and you know,
well, then if you need that as the impetus to get you in the door. They may say, well, you're not a broadcaster or whatever. Yes, you are. You're working for us.
I would be happy to do that. The public deserves to know. The public wants to peel back the layers of this person. You know, ultimately, we want to understand this. We want to prevent these types of things, and we want to facilitate healing and all the things that can come from understanding why a person would do something like this. There's something, like you mentioned, something in childhood, or there are multiple factors that go into somebody turning out this wrong. And if we have, as a society, can identify it, present it, and help these people before they go on to hurt others, I think that's really what a lot of people are looking to do.
I want to know if the guy abused animals when he was little. Did he hurt dogs and cats? Or, you know,
instances of this guy as an adult during his offenses hurting animals.
Geez, see, there's another telltale heart. Witnesses, neighbors would say that they would hear this guy in his backyard cursing to himself, screaming at himself.
It's very strange, some of the ways that he behaved. Sometimes you wonder, was he doing this to appear a little kooky or unstable in the case that he was caught and he could cop an insanity plea or something like that? Or was there something going on? He was obviously an angry person. A lot of the angry people I've known in my life talk to themselves quite a bit. And so it's hard to tell if this was something naturally. Sometimes it seemed like he was psyching himself up. There was one case where they thought he was going to kill the couple. And he was in the kitchen just chanting, I'll kill him, I'll kill him, I'll kill him. And the victims thought he was actually trying to talk himself into it and psych himself up for it. So it's really hard to say what he was doing and why he was doing it. One of the interesting things that will occur is being able to question the suspect and find out, why did you do this weird thing at this point? And hopefully he'll talk and provide answers.
Was he married at this point? Now?
He was married in 1973, and his crimes began in roughly 1973.
Is he still married?
Oh, I haven't seen a divorce, but they are estranged.
They are estranged, and he still has his two children out there?
Yeah, there are three children that we know of.
See, I'd love to hear from them. I'd love to hear what kind of a dad was he.
Two of them have cooperated. From what I'm hearing, two of them have cooperated with law enforcement and have already talked to them. And there are neighbors and people who have been contacting me who I haven't been able to vet yet, who grew up with some of these kids and who have provided some interesting stories as to the anger level that this suspect showed toward his children and toward other people.
Is there any way a guy like this who could commit these horrendous crimes, rapes and murders, and keep them from his family and they would never know who he was? I guess, as you mentioned, the BTK killer, he was in Wichita or Topeka or something like that, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was down there.
And he kept it from his family. As a matter of fact, he was like a higher up in the church out there. How do you keep that a secret, or where you don't suspect something if you're a kid?
I have no idea. I really don't. He must have worked hard at it. He must have completely dissociated in some way during the commission of the crimes. And when the crimes were being committed, the kids were young. And he generally stopped toward the end of that. And basically, it looked like he revolved his last couple killings around fatherhood, which is a chilling thing to think about.
Now, what do you mean by that?
His first child was born just, I guess it was 2 months after his murder in 1981. And his second child was born, I guess it was 7 months after his murder in 1986. And he took that 5-year break between 1981 and 1986.
Huh. Interesting. And then he started up again after that.
Well, after the 1986, he apparently stopped. We lose track
he
of him
stops.
After that.
He's
but
done.
We do have those creepy phone calls that he would call former victims.
Yeah, we were talking about that. He would call the victims after the fact and threaten them?
Yeah, he would call them before the attacks, and often they were hang-up phone calls where they pick up and there would be nobody on the other line, but they could tell somebody was there, but they wouldn't speak. Sometimes they could hear breathing. There was one point where one of the victims heard a woman coughing in the background. And those seemed to be reconnaissance-type calls. He would see when they were home and when the best time to attack them was, basically by when they would pick up their phone. And then sometimes after the attacks, he would call them and threaten them. In fact, there's an audio recording that we played last time I was on the show of the Golden State Killer actually calling up a victim and threatening them, and it was recorded by the police, and that's really the only known sample of his voice that we actually have. But he would continue even after the murder spree. So 1986 was the last known crime. And then he called a victim in 1982. Well, it was 1982 during that five-year break. He called one in 1984 during that five-year break. Then he called one in about 1991 and then in 2001. And the 2001 phone call came right after the news story broke that DNA had connected his rape crimes to his murder crimes. He called a victim that he'd victimized 25 years before who still lived in the same house. And he called her up and basically threatened her. So that was the last indication that we really had that he was still alive. So it was really interesting and fascinating to find that he was still alive today and that he had basically refrained from that type of behavior.
I got to believe, Keith, he has a journal somewhere.
The profilers say that this is the most likely type of criminal to record his crimes. So if we could find something like that, and they took out boxes and boxes and boxes of items from his house today and yesterday, but if there's something like that that exists, either through a journal or through trophies that he kept from crime scenes, trophies meaning driver's licenses, mm-hmm. articles of clothing and different things, if there's something like that that exists, it would be fascinating to unpack. And I'm not sure how much closure it'll help provide for the victims to see those types of items. It might be quite frightening to find out what was going through his mind while he was committing these types of things or the callous nature in which he did these crimes. But it really would be fascinating to find something like that from a psychological and standpoint and, of course, for the trial.
Do you think he knew they were honing in on him?
The basically firsthand reports that we got from law enforcement were that he at first appeared very bewildered, and then it was clear that he knew what was happening.
Yeah.
And the way that they arrested him, it was very smart. He's a suicide risk. He's a risk of hurting others. So they watched him for a few days, and they figured out the perfect time to get him. And they basically got him when he was close to their vehicle, from what I understand. And they were able to take him in quickly, and law enforcement is telling us that he understood and indicated that he understood the situation that he was in.
He knew what was going on.
Yeah.
He had no gun on him or anything like that?
Not from what I've heard.
If you had a chance to talk to him, and I hope you do for us, what's the first question you're going to ask him?
I'm going to steal a question that one of the victims told me would be her first question. One of the victims... the daughter of one of the murder victims, Debbie Domingo, was asked this question, and I thought she responded brilliantly. She said that she would just ask him, "How dare you? How dare you do these things?" And I thought that was so powerful. And that's really what we want to know. Why would you? What made you do this? What gave you the right to ruin so many lives and marriages, and take these people away from this earth? And what gives you the right to still be here while they're gone?
Somewhere along the line, somebody did something horrendous to this guy.
That's the thinking. And
as a young child, I'm convinced of it.
And this person unknowingly created a monster.
Yes, without a doubt. A horrible, horrible monster. Keith, the book that you wrote with Kat Winters, of course, is on Amazon. It's available to people. Your websites are all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Will police consult you in this case?
I don't know if they will. The law enforcement people that we've been dealing with, from what I understand, a lot of them are going to have to go dark at this point because they're part of the prosecuting jurisdictions.
Yeah.
And the less they say to the public, the better.
Right. They don't want to screw this one up.
And one of the things that really that the, a defense attorney will really zero in on if they're trying to get their client off is how the police handled the evidence that led to this person being identified as a person of interest in the case.
Exactly.
How that part of the investigation went. Who did they talk to? What's the chain of evidence? What led them to believe that, and how was that information handled? So the flow of information becomes very important.
And would the guy cop a plea? Let's talk about that, Keith, and take some phone calls next. And if for some reason you have any experience in these cases, definitely check in with us.